I was living the American dream and had everything you could ever want. A big house, beautiful wives, three wonderful children, two dogs, brand new cars. I was the CEO of a company and I was absolutely miserable.
In this episode, I talk to CEO and the author of the great book, There's Coffee in the Fridge, James Francis. He's going to tell me not only how meditation has dramatically improved his mental health, but also how it can help yours.
Dad Mind Matters, helping men to safely navigate family life without losing their minds. Lived experience podcasts about mental health, parenting and marriage on a Monday, Wednesday and Friday.
My name is James Francis. I wrote a book that was published recently called There's Coffee in the Fridge, a one man's journey through anxiety and depression. My real name is Jim Rainier, but the creative part of me is James Francis. Ultimately, I wrote this book because I wanted other men to know that there's somebody else out there experiencing something that they may be experiencing, and it's okay to talk about it, and it's okay to be vulnerable. And as a business owner, an entrepreneur, a husband, a dad, all of those things come into my work and my journey toward successfully healing some pretty deep traumatic wounds. I'm not afraid to talk about it. And I appreciate you having me on. I really do. It's amazing. Got to spread the word about mental health. And just, I want to start a conversation.
It's brilliant. And I don't think there's ever been a bigger need for it in our society. I've struggled with my mental health for years. I've been on medication for years. I was diagnosed as having OCD, which is intrusive thoughts, and just general, I've had depression from that. And that's an ongoing battle, which can come and go. And but I think you're right. I think it's so important for men to talk about it because traditionally we don't. And that's where the problems arise, I think.
Yeah, agreed. 100%.
So are you happy to talk about where your anxiety started or what sort of triggers there were?
Sure. I think what I will do is start with, there was a flashpoint for me in May of 2005. I pretty much was living the American dream, right? And had everything you could ever want. A big house, beautiful wives, three wonderful children, two dogs, brand new cars. I ran a company. I was the CEO of a company. I had everything from the outside and I was absolutely miserable and just completely unhappy. And so I woke up in a hospital after a suicide attempt, and that's where my journey to healing started. Essentially, that was the flashpoint that pushed me down the path of really starting to learn who I was, the derivation or the starting point for my depression and my anxiety. And I really wanted to identify that. I wanted to understand what the hell is causing this unhappiness. And that's where that started. So I spent some time in a hospital, got myself into a stable and safe place, came out of the hospital. And essentially, my wife said, listen, I don't know where we're going to go here. I don't know where this journey is going to take us, but let's try to figure this out together. And we'll try to learn as much as we can about this process. And essentially, I agreed. And growing up, I was an athlete. I was a college athlete. I was actually an All-American lacrosse player. And that requires a tremendous amount of commitment and discipline. And so I use that same discipline, which is the same discipline I use to run my companies and to run my business, to learn about my mental health and to really understand who I am and what I'm about and why all this shit happened. I was able to identify some pretty aggressive childhood trauma. But the way that I talk about it with people is that I don't care if you've been sexually molested or beaten or hit once, right? That's all an energy. That energy continues inside of you until it's reckoned with. And so it's not really a matter of levels of pain or trauma. It really is just identifying that one thing and trying to understand how to release it. And so that's what I did. I've spent about 4 years following my hospitalization, really going to school on who I am and connecting with myself. And that's why this book became such an important catharsis for me. It really was a culmination of journaling, therapy, multiple modalities of therapy, all on paper in one spot. And then I started to talk about it. I was invited to talk to a group of people here. I live in Connecticut in the US. I was invited to talk to a group of people here, basically business executives, people that are just like me and mostly middle-aged men. And I told my story and several people came up to me afterward and said, you need to write this book. And so that's how it started.
Yeah, that's amazing. I think, and I applaud you for having the courage to A, confront it and deal with it, but also you never know. I mean, for so many people, you might well be the light at the end of the tunnel. You don't know who your book might connect with. And I think that's why it's so important to, and I totally agree with you. I think a lot of anxiety and depression comes out from unresolved trauma as a child, whatever that is, whether that's something that's happened at home or at school or just, and I think it's not if it comes out, it's going to come out, it's when it comes out. And it's how you either, it can either change your life and it can be a complete epiphany and make you much happier. So you play a much stronger second half of your life, but it's hard. You've got, and some people don't want to face those demons. So I applaud you because it's, I think it's one thing to admit it to yourself and maybe talk to a counselor or a therapist. It's a whole different level to put it down on paper.
Yeah, agreed. And so for me, I spent that time learning and then I had to go back to work, right? Everything's a choice and I didn't have to go back to work, but we sat down, we were out of money and we were like, what do you want to do? Do you want to move? Do you want to go, you know, downsize our lives? And obviously, as long as we're together, it's all good. But ultimately, I chose to go back into the business that I was in, a little bit different area, more focused on being and helping people with healthy behaviors. I spend a lot of time in the corporate insurance world. And what I started to do was bring what I've learned into the boardroom. Essentially, I was the CEO of a couple of companies. I'm currently the COO of a company. And so I bring the way that I live into the boardroom. And I started to do that about 12 years ago, teaching people how to meditate, essentially, small groups, one-on-one, whatever. And it amazed me how many people were just thirsting for this stuff, right? Yeah. They read about it. They've heard about it. They know somebody who does it. And so I started to bring this into work and I started to tell some of the stories that I've reflected on in my book. And people started to open up and started to become vulnerable. And it's the workplace. You can't get too touchy-feely, but as long as people know that there's space for it, it's amazing how quickly people opened up. And I saw the dramatic need. And to your point, I think most people are walking around numb and they're afraid, right? They're afraid to front whatever it is. They don't think it can change. They don't think that it can be helped. And once you start to have that interaction and to break it down and to show people how really easy it is, it's not simple, but it is easy, right? Then they start to gravitate to, holy shit, yeah, I could live a different existence. This is pretty amazing.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think most people numb it with either alcohol or drugs or addictions, or those are coping strategies so that people can function. But I think, because I meditate as well, and I think it's really hard when you start just to sit and be with yourself for 5 minutes. I find that, and it's less so now because it's something I've obviously practiced, but the first 5 minutes, I've got a brain that's just, what are you doing? You've got work to do. Get up. It's like having a toddler who just will not. They're relentless with whatever it is they want you to do. Your mind can be like that. It's a game changer. It's like those snow cones you get and your mind's like that. It's like a shaken snow cone. And then after a couple of minutes, it all settles. And that piece is something that I would say 99% of the world doesn't know exists.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I call that teaching your ego that it's not the CEO, right? The minute you wake up, your mind's a computer and it's off to work, right? It does what it needs to do. And meditation for me teaches my mind and my ego that it's not the CEO. I'm the CEO. I'm in charge. There's a place for you, but your job is this, right? And so meditation allows me to calm that down and really be specific about how I want the brain to function in that short period of time. Sometimes during the day, it's just going crazy. But for the most part, when I need to calm myself down, I can do that. I can get right to my breath and just quiet things down. I call it slowing down for speeding up, right? Because if you meditate, you can be more creative, more collaborative, more interactive, all the things that come out of that. But if you're not able to calm yourself and get into a place where you know that you're in control, then that's when the white noise continues to just fly and fly around the head.
The fact that you speak of an ego, it's like a distance from you. Your higher self knows the ego. I started training Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu about 6 years ago. And that is a very good confrontation with your ego, because you can either handle being rubbish. Yeah. I remember literally my first trial class, and I did it 2 weeks after my 40th birthday. And I played a lot of rugby. I'd done judo growing up. I'd run marathons. I'd done more swimming. And I literally got paired up with this, I'd say, 15-year-old girl. And I was like, I don't want to roll with her. I'm going to hurt her. She absolutely battered me. And I just, after the first two rolls, I'm like, okay, I'm taking it seriously now. And even using everything I had, I was helpless. It was like me rolling with my like 5-year-old son. And I just thought, I've got to learn this. This is amazing.
Wow.
One of the black belts after, who I think had seen probably lots of people in my position on a trial class, go, look, you're on a very steep trajectory. The first thing you learn is that you know nothing. You're either excited by that. And if you're excited by that, you're going down a path that's so much more than you think it is. Some people can't handle that. Some guys will come into the gym with this idea of who they are, and it can't be handled being submitted by someone who's physically smaller or weaker in their perception. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, and you're right, meditation is a very good way of distancing yourself, your higher self, with your ego. But it takes work, and a lot of people don't want to do the work.
Yeah, and I think mental health, just in general, takes a lot of work, right? And if you think about jiu-jitsu and the subtleties, right, that you start to learn as you get more advanced, that's the same thing in therapy, right? You get those subtle actions that might have a huge seismic shift in the way you look at something. But in order to get there, you got to start, and you got to start to break down the walls and get deeper and deeper. And sometimes it can take months, and sometimes it can take a couple of hours, but that work has to be done. And so for me, I approach that work as an athlete. And to your point of what you said, second half of life, you can start to live your best self. And it's very true. Then I started to look at my children, right? I have 3 kids. At the time of my suicide attempt, they were 12, 10, and 6. And I had this opportunity, once I started to get connected with myself and forgive myself for all the stuff that I had done and the fact that I tried to take myself off the planet, I said, I'm going to end this cycle. I want to teach my children how to communicate their feelings, how to connect with their emotions and do the things that I'm doing. And so that's where the work continues. So now I know, the second half of my life is going to be phenomenal. But now they've got their entire lives in front of them, right? And so that, as a parent, was something that was really important.
Yeah, because what you're doing is you're saving your own life, but you're also saving the life of your children. My father struggled with his mental health. I struggled with mine. I have 3 children who all I can see may well have similar issues. And if you can teach them coping strategies now and they say, look, in the same way that you keep fit, your body fit, you need to keep your mind fit. I'm not trying to pry or anything, but were there any triggers leading up to your suicide attempt? Was there anything, or do you think it was just a culmination of building of pressure in your life? Or,
well, on the day that I decided to kill myself, there was some financial pressures. I was running a company that I owned, and we were growing, but there was a lot of financial pressure to continue that. And I had my brother-in-law was one of my partners. I worked with I had 4 employees that were all people that had worked with me for years at other companies. And now this was my company, right?
Yeah.
So the financial pressure of that just built and built over time. And if I had to point to one trigger, that would probably be it. The second trigger was really a culmination over time. My wife is a very happy person. She's always been a happy person. She's never dealt with mental health issues. And she would say to me, how come you're not happy? And we had this conversation for years. We, at the time, had been together for 20 years. And it used to drive me crazy that I couldn't feel happy and literally couldn't feel it. There were moments where I would experience something and I'd feel like, okay, yeah, this is happy, but it would go away very quickly. Craig's example, if I went to a party with a bunch of friends and I left feeling just completely empty, right? That unhappiness over time just built up. And I was like, if this is all there is, then I don't want to be here anymore.
Yeah. Because what you said about your sporting background with lacrosse, and obviously you don't get to be a CEO unless you're incredibly driven. It's not for everyone. I got quite bullied at school. And I think I obviously grew up with a fairly low self-esteem, which I think can manifest itself in overachieving, running marathons, bungee jumps, jumping out of planes, doing things that a little bit proving to my self-worth to myself. And I imagine there are lots of very overachieving people who maybe, I don't know, are trying to prove to something or are trying to write something that hasn't been resolved. And hopefully you resolve it at a time when you've still got half your life to live and you can not only support yourself and your children, but you write a book. The problem is people aren't great at telling. Someone will write, read your book and go, oh, wow, that's changed my life. That's an epiphany. I hope they reach out and tell you, because quite often people don't. And I think there's a big stigma about mental health, especially talking about suicide. And one of the things I'm hoping with my podcast is you just talk about it. I always find I'm much braver for my children than I am for myself. If you can't feel to do it for yourself, which I get, absolutely, but do it for your kids, because they may really need to hear this. They may really need, in their 30s, 40s, they might get to the same point of view and think, okay, I've got a roadmap for this. Dad talked about this. Dad wrote a book about this. Dad did podcast. Do you see what I mean? So I think the work you're doing is invaluable.
Yeah, and I think you hit the nail on the head and you said you've got mental health issues. Your dad had mental health issues. These things don't go away, right? They just get passed from generation to generation. That was something that I was really intent on ending. I wanted to end. They're going to have their own issues, but I know factually that their genetic makeup includes the depression that exists inside of me, that existed inside of my father and existed inside of my mom. And there were multiple suicides on both sides of my family going back 2-3 generations. So it's there. And so why not learn how to manage it, essentially? And the thing is that I spoke to a group of people a couple of weeks ago, and somebody in the room was not in a good place. And the person that they came with asked the question, what advice would you give to someone that is not in a good place right now? And the best advice I have is, look, on my worst day, I never imagined that a day like today could exist, that I could actually feel joy in having a conversation with you. And so that's the advice, is that regardless of how bad things are going right now, no matter how low you feel, you can get there. There is a day like today that you just don't know about yet. And living for that goal, to me, is pretty important.
Whatever it is, whatever your anchor is, whether it's your children, they often say, if you've got a problem, get a bigger problem. That's a very good way of, it's why I do this, the podcast, because it's a way of cathartically feeling like, okay, I'm using this nervous energy that I have to hopefully, A, to help myself, but also maybe reach someone. And it just has to be an ongoing conversation, and it has to be, and it isn't yet. It isn't. It's still a massive stigma for men to say, I'm suffering, I'm struggling. We're not there. And I think there's a narrative where I think women go, I want a sensitive man. I go, do you? I get that. But actually, it's still in our society not deemed an attractive trait. I would probably more likely talk and share my problems with my male friends than I would with my wife, just because, I don't know, I think it's, as a man, your role is, I've got to provide. I've got to get up and do this. And imagine, I'm not surprised that your level of stress, certainly if you're feeling like, actually, the buck stops at me. I'm the head guy. If this doesn't work, it's not just my salary or my family, it's other people's. That's a lot of pressure to carry on one set of shoulders.
Yeah, it is. I do it willingly now, but there are other factors, right? If you want to live at a peak level, right, you've got to get the right amount of sleep. You've got to drink the right amount of water. You've got to eat the right amount of food. During that period, probably 5 months prior to my attempted suicide, I was not taking good care of myself. And when my anxiety gets really bad, I know that I have got to shut down. I've got to get 8 hours of sleep, and I've got to be calm as much as I can through the day and drink a lot of water and all the things that I identified for myself that are really on my roadmap to being healthy. And I wasn't doing that. The other thing is I had a surgery, had a torn rotator cuff, and I had rotator cuff surgery in January. So that event happened in May, 4 months before I had this surgery. And so I was pretty physically debilitated, right? I was not exercising. And for me, exercise is like one of the key things in order for me to balance my life. So that combination of not taking care of myself, that financial pressure, and not exercising was just a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, I think something you said earlier in our conversation, it is simple. It's just not easy. We all know what we need to do. Yeah. And the difference between If I have a glass of wine or a beer, it's good. I know tomorrow there's a bill to pay for that. I know that anxiety will be up, my intrusive thoughts will be up, I'll be self-doubting. It's difficult because actually, if you live in this world and you've got to provide and you've got kids, sometimes you need a beer or a glass of wine at the end of the day.
Absolutely.
But I think you're right. It's 8 hours sleep. It's not drinking coffee past 2 o'clock or 4 o'clock. Not being on my phone an hour before I go to bed. Because if I do, my brain's not going to turn off. We're probably very similar men. I've got a brain that needs no encouragement. Be running like a motor. So you have to do that stuff. Cold water therapy, meditation. And you have to, I think, you've got to look at it like a job.
I think the other thing is, I'll give you a quick observation. I've had a crazy couple of weeks. And I was in Los Angeles. I live in Connecticut. I flew to Los Angeles last week. This on Thursday and Friday, it was a quick turnaround. Monday, I flew to Puerto Rico for a meeting with some insurance folks that I work with. And I'm at the John F. Kennedy Airport in New York, right? For a 12:30 flight. Long story short, the flight didn't take off until about 6 p.m. It was mayhem in the terminal. People were going crazy. They were yelling at the ticket agents, screaming at each other. It was just a crazy situation. Because of what I've lived through, I can observe this now and really see how people completely lose control. And the bottom line is, we don't have control over anything, right? You only have control over your own reaction to stuff, which everybody says. But watching people lose control over something that they think they actually have control over is a really interesting experiment. And so I just take a step back and I'm like, you know what? This sucks. I don't want to be sitting in this terminal for 5 hours, but I also don't want to get on a plane that's going to fall out of the sky, right?
Yeah.
So I'm just going to relax and do some other things and stretch and whatever. And eventually you get there. But watching that anxiety build up and that energy start to explode inside of this population of 250 people is shocking.
It's just, as you said, it's a very good snapshot at society. And all those people getting angry are being led by their ego. I should get what I want. Should you? The fact that you can diss and say, it is what it is. I can't control it. Yeah. Getting cross is not going to help. So I'm going to speed it up. The fact that you've actually done that work and there is a dip when you talk about yourself, there is a difference between your ego and your higher self. It can only mean, I think, that the rest of your life is going to be, that you've got an awareness that most people don't have, but you had to do some work and probably go through some really traumatic experiences to do that.
Yeah, for sure. And the message that I give people is just start simply. Just do something simple. You don't have to do everything, right? There's a couple of things that you can start right away. One of those is meditation. And I teach people how to meditate using music so that it's really simple for them to get into it. 30 seconds, a minute and a half, start drinking a lot of water, get regular sleep. There's a list of things that I basically preach to a certain extent, but you don't have to do them all. I have 10 things that I try to keep consciously aware of for myself, but you could just do 2, right? Just start simply, at least just start and start to become aware of some of the way the changes that occur as a result.
It is the starting that's the tough thing, because a lot of people, and I put myself as this, you'd be like, oh no, I'm all right. I'm just someone that drinks coffee that's why there's a problem. Oh no, I'm fine. I'm someone that does that. Your ego's talking. Your ego, and this isn't working for you. So whatever narrative you're telling yourself, the anxiety and those intrusive thoughts are coming from something that you are doing that is actually not serving you. And the fact that you're not even prepared to try is actually your ego's in the steering wheel. If you know there's a better option, that might mean that at the moment, okay, I have to do some work, or I don't get the instant gratification now, but it means that by doing some work, my life's better. It's worth doing, because everyone's got fault lines. Everyone's got trauma and scars that haven't healed, or for whatever reason, just things happen in life you can't control. Well, it's not if it happens, it's when. And when that stuff happens, if you haven't done any, if you're not mentally in a place where you lose someone close to you, or you lose your job, or you have a major problem in your marriage or something, if you haven't done any work on yourself, then that could be too much.
Yeah, I agree. I think the other thing is people are afraid to be labeled. I know I was, right? I didn't want to be labeled. You mentioned earlier you're on medication. I took medication for, I don't know, 8 years, and I was terrified to be labeled with depression, and then also then to have to be on medication, right? That I can't function in the world without having some sort of a crutch. And that's just an insane stigma that we all learn at a very young age. And I think letting go of that and also saying, yeah, you know what? I do have depression. I do have anxiety, but that's not who I am. It's just part of my experience. And medication, I go to an accountant to do all my taxes, right? So, yeah. And if I was diabetic, I'd be taking insulin. So it's the same thing, right? And then once you start to calm things down, then you can start to do some more work.
Yeah, I think you're right. Some people don't produce enough serotonin in their body. Some, in the same way that people have arthritis problems or type 1 diabetes, there are some bodies that don't produce what they need to be optimum. So
yeah,
it's not a big deal. Whenever I go to my GP, my doctor, and say, look, I want to come off this. He said, I get it. But you've got 3 young children. Life is about as stressful. I imagine, irrespective of what time you go to bed, our kids still pad through in the middle of the night. Sleep's just, you only get to control so much. He said, choose your battles. I get it. You don't want to be on antidepressants, and you probably won't be. But just at the moment when life is full on, maybe just allow yourself that, do you know what? It's not ideal, but it's not forever. And actually, if it's helping me function and be a better dad and husband, then just do it. Again, that's ego. That's like, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter.
Yeah. So you just said allow, and that is exactly the right way to phrase it, right? If I came to you tomorrow and we just met, if I came to you tomorrow and said, hey, you know what? I need help. Can you help me with this? Your inclination would be, I'll help you. You're a total stranger, but I'll help you.
Yeah.
So why not help yourself, right? Ask yourself for help and say, yeah, you know what? I want to help. That's a natural inclination. And to me, allowing that space is how you're actually helping and giving that gift to yourself, which is something that I know I didn't learn as a kid. And that's what we need to teach our children, is it's okay to want to take care of yourself so that you can be 100% for everybody around you. And so I think that word allow is really important.
I know, talking to some of my friends, you start talking about loving yourself, I can see them going, I'm not that guy. I'm like, I get it. It's just, but think about the airplane. They say, you've got to put your own oxygen mask on first. Otherwise you're useless. You can't do anything. You're not going to help your kids if you're absolutely crippled with anxiety. And I find it much easier. And I think this might come from, I don't know, being bullied as a boy. I was overweight as a kid, and therefore self-esteem wasn't great. So maybe I've never thought I was enough. So I'm always, do it. I do it for my kids. Do it because they need you to be better. I get it that some people go, for whatever reason, it feels hard to do it for myself. Fine, I get it. No problem. Do it for the kids. They need you to do it. Actually, that's really important. And I think you'll be so much braver for your children. I certainly found becoming a father gave me a drive and a courage and a bravery that I didn't have before. I'd do stuff that I'd go for jobs, I'd public speaking, all sorts of things. This, I would never have thought of this before.
Yeah.
But if you have I'm doing this because my son might really need to hear this conversation in 20 years' time. It's a really good shift, I think. Certainly for men.
Yeah, I agree. That's awesome. I think what you're doing is an incredible gift. I really do. We just need to start a conversation and keep talking about it. And men need to have their hands held as much as they don't want to. They really do. And it's not just for men, right? It's for the people that want to love them or do love them to start to understand a little bit more about some of the barriers that exist that are real and imagined. And they're real barriers. I lived for a long time just basically my head down, arms swimming, and I'm going to achieve. But at the same time, not being willing to sit down and say, you know what? I'm scared shitless. I have no idea what to do next. And that's okay.
Just before I forget, because I think I've got 5 minutes left before the Zoom goes, where can people find your book? Is it on Amazon?
It is. It's on Amazon. There's Coffee in the Fridge. You can look it up on Amazon. I've got an Instagram page. There's Coffee in the Fridge. Facebook page, same name. We've got a TikTok and a link. And just really quick before we go, I'll tell you the meaning behind the title. And so I had gone to the hospital, came out of the hospital, did a bunch of work. A couple of years later, I'm back in a sort of regular job and getting ready to go on my first business trip. And I hadn't been on a trip in at least 2.5 years. And I had done a lot of traveling prior to that. And so I was getting ready to go, and I'm pretty nervous and anxious about going back into the world that had I basically thought I had failed it. And I said to my wife, look, I'm going to leave at 4 o'clock in the morning. I got to catch an early flight. I made some coffee and I put it in the fridge and I'm just going to grab that and I'm going to go to the airport. So my wife sleeps pretty late, or at least she did at the time. She would say she's a night owl. I'm not, but she would normally sleep till 7 or 8 in the morning. And I got up around 4, I tiptoed around the bed. I kissed her on the cheek and I said, I'm going to go. And she turned to me with this big smile and she said, there's coffee in the fridge. And like that connection, she was basically saying, I'm with you. You're going to be fine. And so the purpose of that for the book title for me is that like that one moment is just magical. And those are the things that bring meaning to life.
It's a lovely story. And as you said, you can have all the money in the world and all the status, but you can't create a genuine connection with another human being like that. If you're lucky and you do the work, you'll get that. But it's not something that can be attained unless you are prepared to be really vulnerable. And I admire you for doing that.
I really hope you got something from this podcast. And if you have a specific question about OCD or mental health that you'd like me to try and do my best to answer, please let me know. You can contact me at www.dadmindmatters.com. And if you're going through or have gone through a mental health issue and you found a way to make your life slightly easier and you want to share that story, please also contact me. And I know it's a massive ask because no one's got any spare time, but I'm really trying to get this podcast out there. So if you have 2 minutes to leave me a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, that would be hugely appreciated. I hope wherever you are in the world, you're okay. Take care of yourself. My book, First Time Dad, A 42-Week Guide to Pregnancy, is available in Kindle and paperback form on Amazon and an audiobook form on Audible. To sign up for my monthly newsletter, please visit my website, www.dadmindmatters.com.